Okay, it's time to get started. I want to welcome everyone out to our Wildlife Board meeting today. My name is Jake Albrecht. I'm from Glenwood, Sevier County. And I want to welcome our Wildlife Board members. We'll start on my left, which is Steve Dalton from Teasdale. Southern region, for you don't know where that's in Wayne County. Kirk Woodward from Vernal, from the Northeast region. Calvin Crandall from Springville, which is the Central region. Bill Fenimore is our vice chair. He's also from Farmington, the Northern region. Then on my right is Director Greg Sheehan, who is our acting executive secretary today. He does not have a vote. And then John Baer has asked to be excused. And then we have Mike King from Price from the Southeast region. Also, we have Stacy Coons, who is the wildlife coordinator, and Tuvo Wood, who is the director's executive secretary, helping with the minutes today. And then our rack chairs, Stacy's got them all messed up again. We usually have the southern on the far south and the northern on the north, but we'll leave it at that.
Kind of new at this. Maybe she'll get
it. So we have Robbie Edgel, do I pronounce that right? Setting in at the southeast table today. Dave Black from the southern region. Boyd Blackwell setting in from the northeast. And central is Gary Nielsen. And then from the northern today, we have John Caveat, who is a professor at Weber State University, and he also wore the purple and gold colors of Wayne County, Steve. So,
good boy.
You're ready to rumble. Before I get in today's agenda, I want to give how our meeting procedures will work. First, we'll hear and view the presentation. And we'll hear questions from the board, questions from these rack chairs, questions from the audience, and then we'll have a rack chair summary motions, what happened at their racks. And then we'll have comments from the audience. And this requires a comment card to be filled out with your name and what agenda item you'd like to talk about. And then I'll summarize the rack motions and the discussion with the Wildlife Board, and we'll go into motions from there. So our first item of business today is to approve the agenda, Thursday, March the 5th. Motion by Mr. Fenimore. Second by Kirk. All in favor? Dr. Kirk. Motion carries. Okay. We need also a motion to approve the minutes of January the 6th board meeting. And I went through those and I could not find any corrections. It's been a couple months, but from what I've seen there,
there's some corrections, but we got them straightened out, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
That cut and paste from meetings, I don't know how far back, sometimes comes back to haunt you.
Okay, so do we have any corrections to those minutes?
I move we approve the minutes of the
January 6th
board meeting.
Motion
as corrected.
Calvin Crandall, second by Steve Dalton.
What was corrected?
Half the board was missing.
Oh. They were excused.
They were excused, but they actually were making motions, but they were excused. So we got that straightened out.
Okay, all in favor? Any against? All right, motion carries. Our action log today, we don't have anything there, so we'll move to our DWR update. Director Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief today. This board meeting came out primarily as a result of changes that we'll spend a fair amount of time on today with the Utah Prairie Dogs. So this wasn't a meeting that we scheduled last year or when our other meetings were scheduled. So I'm going to keep my comments brief today so we can move into that topic, and we'll have maybe a little more extensive discussion our next board meeting that's coming up in a month or two. Just three things I want to touch on today. We've got an aquatics summit that we'll call it that's coming up, and we've invited all of our board members, all of our RAC members, and if there's other interested aquatics folks that are associated with some of our angling groups or other aquatic groups in the state, we may be able to accommodate them as well if they contact us. But primarily this is a one-day event. It's coming up on March 19th, and we're very hopeful that we can get all of you there. And you are RAC chairs that are here today, if you could help push that message back down to your folks, we would sure appreciate that. The intent of it is to bring more understanding and awareness of what's going on in our waterways and aquatic programs around the state. Most of the board meetings that we have here address with more terrestrial species, big game and other things, avian type thing, species. We don't spend a whole lot of time in the aquatic realm, but it's an important part of the management, a huge part of our division, a huge part of our customer base, and we want you to be informed of what's going on in that world. So we've created this event. I believe it starts at 10 a.m. Who's here helping me out with that? 10 a.m. on the 19th. It's down in our Springville office. We tried to get a sort of a centralized location in the state here so that we could get as many people as possible. But we'd appreciate your support. There's some good presentations laid out. It'll only last about, I think, 4 hours we've got scheduled. So includes a short hatchery tour, lunch, and some other really good information that will be provided by some of our angler groups out there. Big game application period. Many of you are tuned into that. That happens to coincidentally end tonight at 11 p.m. So you guys need to stay focused on the meeting if you've not already done that. And if you're interested in applying only for bonus or preference points, that will go until March 19th, I believe is our date, right, Judy? At 11 p.m. So if you missed the applying for the actual hunt tonight, you do have a little second chance to at least put in for some bonus or preference points over the next couple weeks. Last item I wanted to cover today was Wildlife Board nominations. We're in a period of time now when every other year we rotate a couple of board members off. This year we're unfortunately going to lose Bill Fenimore and Jake Albrecht, our chair and vice chair. And we'll have two new members that will join us. Right now through March 15th, 16th, we are accepting applications for the Wildlife Board. And those applications can be found online, Stacy?
Yeah, on our division website.
On the division website. I don't know if that picked up on the microphones or not, but please go on, and I think it describes the process there and what some of the criteria are on that to that end. So with that, I think those are all the updates I had. If Mr. Chairman, if I could just share a thought for a moment on this prairie dog plan, and then we'll let you move on to that agenda item. But I was able to attend the Central Region RAC on Tuesday evening. We did all those throughout the state on the same night. That's not normal, but we don't normally have these sort of emergency, if you will, type meetings arise. So we did those on that evening. But I think it's important for folks to understand that the Division of Wildlife did not just start in the prairie dog business after Judge Benson came up with a ruling, and that will be discussed if you're not familiar with that. We've been in the prairie dog business for decades now. Our biologists are the folks on the ground that are doing the translocations, that are doing the survey work, that are really the front line of the good work that's being done for prairie dogs now. I think our folks have as much expertise and tenure out there as anybody on the planet, and they do a wonderful job with those prairie dog populations. So as we get into this effort, just know that our people have been involved in all the planning that's done, all the hands-on work, all the groundwork that's done, and they're very interested and ensuring and promoting a healthy prairie dog population. They certainly are not. This is not a time that the division has it, and we're throwing our hands up and they're wondering how to best manage these things. We've been doing it for decades. We have employees that work for us who've been doing it individually for decades. We understand what we're doing. We understand planning processes, and I want you to know that as you see this and hear some of the comments that will ensue today. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Director. We'll go to item 5, which is our Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan. Mr. Kevin Bunnell will take care of that this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I used to do this all the time, but it's been a while, so bear with me. Let me first get on the right slide. Thanks, Boyd. So as was mentioned, I'm here to present the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan for non-federal lands. And just a little bit of history to elaborate on what Greg alluded to, what got us to this point. There's a group of citizens down in the Cedar City area that over time had decided to become active and act on the frustrations that they'd had relative to the restrictions on private property associated with Utah Prairie Dogs, and organized themselves into a group that's known as PETPO, stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Property Owners. And about 18 months ago, they filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over this issue of private property rights. That suit was ruled on November 5th in the Utah Federal District Court by Judge D. Benson. And in that ruling, he essentially vacated the authority of the Fish and Wildlife Service to regulate the take of Utah prairie dogs on non-federal land. The basis of the ruling, it ties in with the Commerce Clause and essentially but the fact that Utah prairie dogs are intrastate. They only occur in Utah and have no economic value. And so based on that, he ruled that Congress didn't have the authority to invoke the Commerce Clause in the case of Utah prairie dogs. And in essence, what that did is that returned management authority to the state of Utah and the Division of Wildlife Resources on non-federal lands. And that's what got us to this point. At that point, we realized that we needed to get a state plan in place. We've been operating under the Endangered Species Act listing for 41 years previous. A little more background. Utah prairie dogs are one of 5 species found in North America. They only exist in southwestern Utah, as I mentioned, and the purple polygon there on the far left is the range of Utah prairie dogs. And just for reference, the blue is black-tailed prairie dogs. The kind of orange-red color is white-tailed prairie dogs, and the yellow there is Gunnison prairie dogs. They were listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act in 1973. Largely because of a restriction in range and reduction in numbers. This map's a little hard to see on my screen. Looks like it looks better up there, but the pink is the historic range of Utah prairie dogs. The blue is the current range, and that's a little misleading because those are buffered to make it look larger than what it probably actually is. They were downlisted to threatened in 1984. Currently, about 70% of the population of Utah prairie dogs is on non-federal lands, so the lands that will be covered by this plan. They use sage steppe habitats and have a diet of grass and forbs, and they produce 1 litter a year with an average of 4 young per litter. The management history, again, adding a little more detail to what Greg mentioned, that the basic management is consisted of spring counts, which gives us a population estimate based on the number of adults that are on the landscape prior to the annual reproduction cycle. We've been doing translocations for many years, and then we do issue control permits for take primarily on agricultural lands and in other to allow development and other issues. And that's all been done under the auspices of the Endangered Species Act up until this point. There are a lot of habitat conservation plans throughout the range of Utah prairie dogs. Most recently, we've had 2 what are called low-effect habitat conservation plans put in place in both Iron and Garfield counties, and those were quite helpful this last year. Essentially, what a habitat conservation plan is it allow it lays out how take can be allotted on private land, so the removal of prairie dogs and what has to be done to do that. There is a recovery plan for Utah prairie dogs, and the main goal within that plan is to have 100 counted adults on public or protected lands in each of the three recovery units. Excuse me, 1,000. I made that mistake at the RAC meeting too. 1,000 counted prairie dogs and 5,000 protected occupied acres of habitat. So with that background, I'll move now into the plan. Let me first acknowledge we put together a pretty large group to help us navigate what was appropriate in this in putting together a plan for private lands. You can see all of the players there. This group came together very well. This process started on December 4th, and here within 3 months we're presenting a plan to the board. Which was not an easy task, but the group actually worked very well together, and without that we wouldn't have been to this point. Spend a little bit of time on the goal of the plan. Let me just read it first. That it's to remove restrictions from private property through a timely and structured process, while assisting in the conservation of populations on designated federal and protected non-federal lands. So there's obviously two parts to that goal. The first one deals with back to the court case and what got us here to begin with and the restrictions on private property. But it's also just as important that we continue to apply conservation measures to Utah prairie dogs and increase populations out on the recovery areas so that we can reach the goal that I mentioned earlier. The overall goal here is to have prairie dogs removed from the Protections of the Endangered Species Act, and we only do that by making sure that we have healthy populations out on federal and protected lands. The plan is structured with objectives followed by strategies that will be implemented to achieve those objectives, and I'll go through those one by one. The first one is to develop a cooperative education information mechanism. That's something that we'll work cooperatively with the counties on, because it ties in with some of the building permits and other things that are handled through county and city governments. And so we'll be working with them over the next year to get something in place to ease that process. And then we'll be coordinating a series of outreach campaigns this spring to inform the public of what the plan does and what's authorized and what isn't. Moving on to the next objective, which is to remove restrictions on all federal lands that are not occupied by Utah prairie dogs. I'll show you some maps that illustrate that here in just a minute. But in essence, properties that aren't mapped as Utah prairie dog habitat as of 2014 are essentially exempt from the provisions in this plan, as are properties that are mapped but have been unoccupied for 5 years. For the five previous years, and it'll be the responsibility of the Division of Wildlife to maintain a database of mapped and occupied properties, so that as we interact with that permitting process that I mentioned earlier, primarily with building permits that are issued by cities and counties, we can make sure that that's accurate and we know where we need to apply the plan and where we don't. So this just the map on the left there in green. Shows the areas that up until now have been under some level of restrictions in the Cedar City and Enoch area associated with Utah prairie dogs. This map's created by a buffering, I think 1,300 feet around each of the occupied colonies. And so any development or any surface disturbing activities that took place within that area, prairie dogs had to be dealt with. Under the plan that's being proposed today, that reduces down to just the purple areas on the map on the right, which is the actual boundaries of the colonies that are currently occupied. And the net effect there is about 51,000 acres just in the Cedar City and Enoch area where prairie dog restrictions will be removed.
Can I just get a clarification, Kevin? Sorry to interrupt. So these are the actual boundaries of the colonies. And
well,
but is there still a little bit of buffering there?
There's no buffering. But what it is, it's the boundaries of the parcels of land by different ownership that touch an occupied colony. So if you have a 5-acre piece or a 10-acre piece of property, a parcel of land that's owned by one property owner, it may have just a corner of that has prairie that touches the colony, but that whole parcel is included in this map. Does that help, Mike? Okay. The next objective in the plan deals with health, safety, and welfare concern areas. This has probably been the area of the most conflict that we've had in recent years within the range of Utah prairie dogs, where we have prairie dogs in and around homes and playgrounds and cemeteries and golf courses, and there's a lot of discontent that's been a result of that, and there's been a lot of work done to try to resolve that over the last couple of years, but we hope to continue down that path. And so the objective here is to remove conflicts on non-federal lands where Utah prairie dogs impact health, human health, safety, and welfare. And the strategy there is that all prairie dogs can be removed without a permit in these circumstances. But we are requiring that the division be notified prior to action being taken, and then the number of prairie dogs removed also be reported. And that's, the court case that I mentioned earlier, and I should have clarified this then, has been appealed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So there will be an ongoing court process that's associated with that ruling, and this plan will certainly become a part of that. And so we need to make sure we account for the impacts that this plan may have through making sure that things are documented, and that's why the requirement for letting us know and that an action is going to take place and how many prairie dogs were removed. And just to clarify that, a human health and safety areas are defined as parks, school grounds, residential areas. So within any place that's within 50 feet of an occupied dwelling would qualify under this provision, as well as, cultural sites, cemeteries, airports, places where we've had conflicts in the past. Another objective under this area is that we will target trapping in areas where Utah prairie dogs have the potential to create these health concerns. The reality of it is, in these situations, there's very few tools that people can use to try to remove prairie dogs. Shooting's not an option because you're within city boundaries. There are lethal traps that can be used, and those would be authorized, but the best and easiest way to resolve these concerns is to have the division, to have us come out and trap and remove those prairie dogs and translocate them out to the protected areas, and we will do that proactively and going in areas that we already know where there's going to be conflicts and starting that as soon as the prairie dogs emerge this spring, and then also when we have requests from individual landowners. Now, there will be some prioritization that will have to take place. If it's two or three prairie dogs on a piece of property and we've got larger areas that we're dealing with, it may come to some points where we'll just ask the landowner to resolve that problem themselves. But when we have resources available and where it makes sense from a conservation standpoint, we will do everything we can to help resolve those situations by removing those prairie dogs with live trapping and translocation.
Kevin, can you stop right there for just a second and answer a couple questions?
Sure.
One is, estimated cost to trap and translocate one prairie dog.
Kirk, I don't know. I'd have to put pencil to paper to try to. And over the last couple of years, we've translocated about 1,500 prairie dogs on probably around $100,000. So whatever that math comes out to be. And less than $100, so.
Can you give me an idea of the health and safety concerns of prairie dogs on a public park? They carry a specific pathogen, or
they do. It's primarily The concern is over plague, which occurs in prairie dog populations. And I will mention the perception of that risk is probably higher than the actual risk, but it's a risk nonetheless. And that's the basis of it. There's also rabies and other zoonotic diseases that could be transmitted by prairie dogs.
Has there been any known outbreaks of the bubonic plague due to a Utah prairie dog?
No, this would actually be Slavatic plague, which is a little bit different, but we don't know of any cases where the plague has been transmitted to humans by prairie dogs. So as kind of a precursor to the rest of the plan, there is an annual take allotment, a maximum number of prairie dogs that we will allow to be removed in a given year. We've set that limit in the plan at 6,000. That's actually a figure that comes out of the regulations that the Fish and Wildlife Service has had in place up until now. So we thought that it was a good number to start with. 6,000 has been the number that they've a maximum that would have been allowed under their 4D permit, which was how people were able to remove prairie dogs from agricultural lands. We do have a provision where we can add additional take. If populations on private property are especially high in a given year, prairie dogs taken for health, safety, and welfare won't be deducted from that number. And prairie dogs that are trapped and relocated won't be deducted from that number. So it will be a range-wide take limit that will be applied to developable lands, lethal control on agricultural lands, and rangelands. So moving into developable areas, and I mentioned the other night, I don't know if developable is even a word, but it fits what we're trying to communicate in this plan. And this is only within mapped habitat, so within the purple areas that were on that map as an example in Cedar City and Enoch that I showed earlier. And so prior to ground disturbance, any property within mapped habitat, we must be contacted to perform an occupancy survey. And then based on the results of that, a couple of different things can happen. If there aren't any prairie dogs found on the particular area where the disturbance is going to take place, we'll simply give them a letter and it will proceed. If there are Utah prairie dogs found, it will still proceed, but we will then account for the loss of those prairie dogs against that 6,000 take allotment that I indicated. And then undeveloped lots with immigrating prairie dogs can be trapped in that instance. In the past, mitigation fees have been one of the sticking points that has had the private landowners and developers has been one of the things that they haven't been happy about. Those go away under this plan, partially because a result of the fact that as the Division of Wildlife, we don't have the authority to charge a mitigation fee for the loss of habitat. That isn't within our statutory authority, and just because it's probably not appropriate in this circumstance. Moving on to agricultural lands, we have an objective to alleviate impacts of Utah prairie dogs on agriculture and range lands, and there are several different strategies for doing that. As it has been the case in the past under the 4D rule, we will continue to give permits for lethal take and removal of Utah prairie dogs on agricultural lands. As mentioned, those will be deducted from that annual take allotment of 6,000. Again, where we have opportunity and have, bang for our buck, for lack of a better term, going back to Kirk's question, we will trap and remove as many of those in as many of those situations as we can. And there's a, let me show you the formula how that the lethal take is calculated. Well, first, so there is kind of a ratcheting scale here that's based on as we have success out on the federal lands, and as numbers on those protected and federal lands, as populations build and we exceed the recovery goals, there's some stipulations in this plan that will allow the take on private land to increase as that takes place. But where we're at currently, and I'll just point out a couple of numbers here. If we had a spring count on a particular piece of agricultural land of 75 adult prairie dogs, through some calculations that help us determine what the actual number of prairie dogs is on that field, accounting for the reproduction that will take place. We would issue a maximum take of 195 prairie dogs under the current scenario for that piece of land. And that what that accounts for is that's 50% of the productivity that would take place, of the 50% of the increase in young born on that piece of property in that given year. And that seems to have been working fairly well. It allows the agricultural guys to, at a minimum, keep prairie dog colonies from expanding and having larger impacts on the private land. We're also hoping to initiate a voluntary incentive program. Now, this is contingent on getting funding from the legislature, but we're very hopeful that we will. And so, if that takes place, agricultural lands that have greater than 50 Utah prairie dogs, a spring count of greater than 50, will be eligible to enroll. If a landowner decides to enroll in this program, they will not have the option for lethal take of Utah prairie dogs. In return, because they will be, we will be trapping and relocating prairie dogs from July through September on those lands. Now, when our crews are done trapping, if we haven't reached the allotted take that could be taken off that particular piece of land, the landowner will be able to come in and apply for a lethal take permit for whatever's left that he would have qualified beforehand that we didn't take through live trapping. The compensation is based on the amount of forage that Utah prairie dogs consume. And I can show you all the calculations that we came up, but it comes out to $45.90 per prairie dog counted in the spring. And then we add an additional 10% of that calculated total to account for damage to equipment and fencing and other impacts that having Utah prairie dogs on that piece of land cause.
Can I ask a question about that, Kevin?
Yeah.
So when you do these counts, I think I read that the cost was based on consumption of alfalfa.
Yes.
And is this on just agricultural land alone, or does it include range land? I mean, if they're out there and there's no crop that's
compensation
planted.
It has to be cultivated agricultural land to qualify. So that kind of concludes the private land portion of the plan. But as I mentioned earlier, there's really two parts to this plan, and the second part is continuing to work towards the recovery goals so that we can eventually remove Utah prairie dogs from the protections of the Endangered Species Act. One of our overarching objectives here is to retain state management authority on non-federal lands and to continue to apply conservation measures on the federal lands so that we can eventually get management authority returned to the state on those lands as well. Several different things, and this is a more or less a continuation of the efforts that have been going on and will continue to go on, maybe with a little more emphasis behind them, but we'll continue to partner with the recovery implementation team and local governments. We'll obviously continue to cooperate with federal agencies. The BLM and the Forest Service in particular have been are very important and key partners in this process. As I mentioned earlier, we're working on establishing a state funding for the management through the legislature. We're not, but there's been a bill introduced by Senator Vickers to do that. We'll monitor translocation sites. We'll work to acquire protected habitats in key locations. We'll continue to work to manage disease. That's largely done by what we refer to as dusting the prairie dog holes in the spring. It's with a chemical that kills the fleas off of the prairie dogs as they come in and out of their holes, and that reduces the probability of the transmission of plague and or having a plague event on an individual colony. And then obviously we'll support ongoing research. There is one very important research project going on right now that's hoping to develop an actual vaccine that can be broadly administered for the plague across the landscape, similar if you're familiar with what they do for rabies in the south, where they actually aerially broadcast a bait that has a vaccine for rabies, and that's done all across the South, primarily with raccoons and other small animals. We're hopeful that a similar product can be developed for plague that can be used not only for Utah prairie dogs, but also whitetails and gunnisons and black-tailed prairie dogs. Continuing on with this, we'll continue to identify and establish translocation sites in cooperation with our federal partners. We'll translocate prairie dogs from non-federal lands, including the safety concerns areas, future development areas, and agricultural areas out to the recovery areas. Continue to support recovery objectives consistent with this plan, and we're working to develop a multi-year translocation plan. For this upcoming season, we have capacity on the recovery areas to translocate about 3,000 prairie dogs, which would be double what we've done in the past, and we hope to go right up to that number. It'll take a lot of work and a lot of effort, but it'll also help resolve a lot of problems if we can be successful and translocate 3,000 prairie dogs this upcoming year. You'll notice there's two agenda items in relation to Utah prairie dogs. The second agenda item is the rules, the administrative rules that are associated with being able to implement this plan. I'll go ahead and go through these now, but you'll probably need to take two different votes relative to the two agenda items. So some things that are contained in the rule that aren't necessarily covered in the plan is first that prairie dogs cannot be taken on federal land except as authorized by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're the ones that have the authority on federal lands under the current court ruling. Prairie dogs can be taken when found within an inhabited structure. And you wouldn't think that happens, but it does. We've had prairie dogs in the courthouse in Garfield. We've had prairie dogs in a assisted living home in Cedar City. So it just makes sense that when we have, and it's rare, but it happens. So we have a provision in here that can be taken care of. We also have a provision that if local law enforcement agencies want to apply for a permit, we can authorize them to take prairie dogs that fall into that health, safety, and welfare category. If there are prairie dogs being removed from private property, it can only be done by the landowner, the lessee, an immediate family member, an employee on the regular payroll, or someone who is approved by the landowner that's a designee. Obviously, nothing in this plan gives somebody the right to go onto somebody else's property and start removing prairie dogs. Prairie dogs can be lethally removed using any means permitted by state, local, or federal law. Currently, that basically comes down to lethal trapping and shooting in some cases. There currently are not any toxicants that are approved for Utah prairie dogs, either specifically on the label, and non-label uses of those products is against federal statutes under the EPA. A person can't live capture or attempt to capture prairie dogs. Prairie dogs or Utah prairie dogs can't be taken on the protected land, so that's an additional category that's. We have some areas that aren't federal land, but they are kind of set aside for conservation of prairie dogs, and obviously they need to be protected as well. We're removing the language associated with the Utah prairie dogs from our non-game mammals rule, which is R657-19, because we're creating a whole new rule that's specific just to Utah prairie dogs. And then we're changing the classification of Utah prairie dogs in Rule R657-3, which is the collection, importation, transportation, and possession rule, from prohibited to controlled. And that's just that gives us some additional flexibility to deal with issues, unforeseen issues. If they stay prohibited and there's something that comes up that we didn't anticipate, the only way to resolve that would actually be to come to the board for a variance. If they're under the prohibited category, under the controlled category, we can make that decision just as the Division of Wildlife. So with that, I appreciate your time and would be glad to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kevin. Any questions from the board? Kirk?
Did
Developable is a word, according to the 1913 Webster Dictionary.
We looked it up in a couple of different places, and it showed up some places and not in others. So.
Yeah. I have a Calvin. Question, and yeah, I think you answered it. Lethal removal. You know, if it comes down to lethal, you can shoot it, but or you can a trap that kills them. But you can't use poison grain, you can't use gas down the burrows, things like that are not permitted on the label pesticides, I guess.
Yes, if it's a labeled pesticide, those can't be used. I suppose if somebody, you know, wanted to hook a hose to their vehicle and stick it down the hole, I don't know if there's a provision that goes against that, but it's been tried and it's not very effective. So.
Okay. Do they not want them to do that because you can't count how many are taken? You don't know, because obviously they want to know in your count what's been removed and what hasn't. Are they afraid that it's going to take too many out of an area? If you use poison grain, it's going to be, I would think, pretty effective. But then you don't know how many are taken because you're not going to find them.
So that would be the concern if there were products out there that were legal to use. But what it comes down to right now is there simply are not any products that can be legally used under the EPA regulations.
For the Utah prairie dogs. I mean, they're obviously very effective for other species. Well, they'd be effective for this, but since they're listed and even, endangered, then we're not going to list them as being able to be used on that animal.
And even the products out there that are approved for other prairie dogs are only approved to be used through a licensed applicator.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that you can go buy over the counter. It's a licensed professional that would be utilizing.
It's not like the stuff I use for the gophers in my backyard.
So Calvin, to clarify, you said so we're not going to allow that because there of some threatened status.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even have a discussion. It doesn't have anything to do with the Utah prairie dog. Every label on those pesticides or whatever those...
They're labeled for certain things.
For certain species, and none of them are labeled for the Utah prairie dog. It's not a matter of us wanting or being able to use those or not. If somebody petitions the EPA and they make a change, then we could be sitting here having this conversation.
Right now, it's not even on the label. Right. Okay. I was just wondering what... You talk about lethal removal, and I was just wondering what are the options for a lethal removal?
And my understanding is even off-label use, like if somebody took a product like Decon that you can buy over the counter and broadcast that out, that would violate current regulations.
I'm going to say you're using something against the label of what it's approved for, so you'd... Okay.
Mike, you got a question?
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of them, but... My first big question is, and this has to do with just numbers of Utah prairie dogs. The plan says that in the 1920s there were 95,000, estimated 95,000. Then said the numbers dropped down to 3,300 or something, and that's when it hit the endangered species list. And it also says that we're currently at 10%, less than 10% of historically occupied range. And then it says the estimates now, like you pointed out, were 16,000 or so on non-federal lands and 6,000 on federal lands or something, about 23,000.
Right.
But then you read on a little bit later and it says that the total population estimate now as of 2014 is 82,000. So I'm wondering how all those numbers fit together, and I'm wondering if we now have 82,000 Utah prairie dogs on less than 10% of the historic range.
Okay, the 10% of the historic range, that's probably expanded. That's what it was when the recovery plan was put in place. It's probably higher than that now, maybe 15 to 20%. I'd have we'd have to do some mapping and refigure that number. The difference between the 16,000 and the 82,000, or the combination of the 16 and the 67, we track prairie dog populations based on spring counts, which we were only accounting adults. Okay, they're a rodent; they have fairly high reproductive rates. They also have very low survival rates, and so during the summer, those numbers swell, and that's the 82,000. If we apply the reproductive rate to the number of adults that we estimate, then you get that 82,000, a total number of prairie dogs that might be on the landscape at its height during the summer of 2014. That retracts back down because of the low survival rate back down, and we'll start figuring that number again this spring at how many of those survived the annual cycle.
The 23,000 has to do with what you would expect to see on the ground before your spring counts.
Yeah, and that even that
as
fluctuates based on winter conditions
in the course of the year.
Yeah. Let me just double check. Adam and Jess, did I
half of that, 'cause that included
survivability, so. Right. So again, when we count, we figure we're only counting half of what we see is only half of what's there. We figure that 50% are under the ground at any given time. We have fairly tight windows of the conditions that we'll count under so that we get as good a count as possible. It has to be a sunny day, low wind conditions, above a certain temperature before it's a valid count. And even under those circumstances, we figure we're only counting 50% of what's there.
Okay, so I would just make a suggestion that maybe you clarify that in the plan, because it may be there, but I didn't pick up on that. So that's just one comment that I would make. The other...
Can I interrupt for a second? So when you talked about the 95,000, they weren't doing spring counted prairie dog counts, you know, 100 years ago or whenever this was done, 90 years ago.
I wouldn't put a lot
so,
of faith in,
we
that.
Don't know how accurate that is. But that being said, those robust numbers may have reflected sort of a summer count as well. We have kind of a scientific protocol that we count under now. We believe maybe there were, you know, 83,000 or whatever the number was here this past summer. So populations are very good right now.
That's really not the question. My question is, how many do we have out there? And it has to do with really if there are many of them out there, then we might be relatively close to recovery status. And it indicates in the plan that you might be 5 or 10 years away from that. But it also brings up the question, is that too many individuals per the occupied habitat that you have? If you've got that many more individuals in a much restricted space, then are you not likely to increase the odds of disease problems and things like that?
You do,
and that's my question.
And that's all part of the recovery plan. We didn't deal with that in this plan because we're dealing with just the private lands, and frankly, that's not where we're trying to recover the species. According to the recovery plan, they have to be out on federal lands or otherwise protected properties, and that plan does deal with all of those scenarios: genetic interchange, disease, protection from disease, so you don't have all your eggs in one basket, and those are all important things. The issue that probably got us to this point is the fact that, and we're at an all-time high right now on the protected lands as well, or not all time, but in recent history, those populations have been growing. It's the distribution that 70% of them are still on the private lands. We need to shift that ratio, and that's what we're working to do.
Any other questions from the board?
Yeah, I got another question. How easy are they to trap? You know, you talk about trap and relocation, and I'm sure these are live traps, but how easy are they to get into a trap and move?
It depends on the situation. If they're food stressed, if they're hungry, they're a lot easier to trap. And so we time trapping, especially on agricultural lands. The best time to trap would be right after a cutting.
Mm-hmm.
On the golf course in Cedar City, where they had pretty lush green grass, and they had been trapped a lot. You know, if you've been trapping a specific area for a lot of years, which we did on the golf course, they can get trap shy. But if you're going into a novel area where they're not familiar with the traps, it can be pretty successful. An example of that, the Paiute tribe has some land that they had a big event happening. They call it their powwow grounds. It's right there in Cedar City, and there was a lot of prairie dogs there last spring, and they asked us to come in and trap. And we removed, I think it was 390 prairie dogs within a couple of days.
Really?
And essentially... that was most of the prairie dogs that were occupying that ground. But that was kind of a perfect storm that came together that allowed us to do that.
What do you put in a trap to lure them in?
Peanut butter.
Anything? Peanut butter works, huh?
Butter.
Sweet.
And we buy it by the gallon and gallon and gallon.
5-gallon bucket the discount store.
When the grocery stores see Jessica back here walking in, they just know what she's coming for.
We got them now. Are they big traps? Are they small traps?
They're about 4 inches square, maybe 18 inches long. Okay, 6 by 6 by 17.
Okay, one at a time, two or three go in at a time. Okay.
So just for the record, multiple in a trap at times, but an adult, usually it's a single animal.
Just most of the time it's just singles. Okay, thanks.
I trapped the same whitetail prairie dog in my garden 3 times, and I kept moving him away farther and farther, and eventually he didn't come back. He must have liked the peanut butter pretty well.
How did you know it was the same one?
I'm gonna interrupt here for a minute because we got some people that need to leave this meeting. Commissioner Miller and Commissioner Pollack, do you need to comment now so that you can go? Okay, so I'm going to forego moving up and down the ladder a little bit and let Commissioner Miller and Commissioner Pollack get up and comment because they have some legislation meetings that they need to attend. So, Commissioner Miller, you're up first. Yeah, just choose that other mic if you would, and we'll leave Kevin at that one in case he has questions.
Yeah, my name is David Miller. I serve as a county commissioner in Iron County. The culmination of this plan really is it's exciting in a lot of ways because we've taken a lot of the best practices that have been implemented, and we've integrated what has been, I think, arguably one of the most important things that needed to happen, especially in Iron County, and I'm sure it's applicable in other areas. But it's the concept of we want to have the local individuals whose private property are impacted on board with us supporting getting this recovery of these species. And this plan actually sets forth some really important pieces that are going to address some of the long-held problems that address the conflicts that have happened with private property. You know, it's taken a lot of leadership. It's taken a lot of teamwork. It's taken a lot of science. It's taken a lot of hours and days and legal prowess. And, you know, to bring this plan together, we wholeheartedly support it. We wholeheartedly support the ruling of Judge Benson. We completely agree with the premise that somebody's private property is their private property, and that private property needs to be administered by those that own it. But with that said, we also recognize that there's a responsibility and a stewardship that comes with wildlife in our community. And so we've taken that approach. We've, from the very get-go, the very beginning of this plan, we've looked at how do we bring together what was heretofore the mutually exclusive approach of, well, let's save this species, and yet let's at all costs save it, despite what happens with private property. And it's been very difficult for people in our communities to be subjected to some of the rules and the regulations that have been very, very troubling. And we've merged this package together of they don't have to be mutually exclusive. We can work together, and this plan provides a lot of those opportunities. I did take a moment and read through the comments that Fish and Wildlife provided. And we appreciate their insights and their involvement. I do want to point out that one of their comments is that regarding developable property. You know, this goes way beyond development. This goes way beyond just protecting somebody's right to go in and have economic advantage in development. This goes right to the very fundamental core of who we are as Americans, and that is that we believe in the sanctity of private property. But we also, with that, comes responsibility, and that's what we've done with this plan. We appreciate Kevin. We appreciate Greg. We appreciate really everybody that's just had their hand in making this happen, biologists right from the ground up with Jess and Adam and Commissioner Pollock over in Garfield County, and really just to see so many people come to the table, state legislature, our senator that represents our area, Evan Vickers, who's been instrumental in many ways. You know, so much work is coming together. But what I'm really pleased and I'm very optimistic about is we're going to recover this prairie dog in a lot shorter time span because we have the ability to move much more rapidly to address issues. You know, when we've got dozens and dozens of prairie dogs getting run over on Highway 56 right up the same street that I drive every morning in and out of town, you know, it concerns me that we're looking at this resource of the prairie dog and we're letting them just get roadkill when we could be putting them, you know, in place a way to translocate those dogs, get them right off of that corridor and put them onto public lands, onto private or a protected property. Those are the things that we have implemented and incorporated into this plan. I'm very optimistic that we're going to see recovery far sooner than would have ever been projected because we don't have to be held to the limiting ability to respond. And we've put in place some checks and balances that assure that because we're agile doesn't mean we're going to be reckless. And so those are just a few of my comments that I wanted to make sure were on the record. We appreciate your consideration and the service that you provide to this great state. Very pleased with DNR all the way up to the very top. AG's office that's been closely involved. And with that said, I don't know if there's any questions that any might have before I sit down.
Thanks, Commissioner Miller. Commissioner Pollock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we appreciate you bumping us up. We do have a busy day at the legislature. First of all, you know, I don't need to echo what Commissioner Miller has already stated. It's a team effort, so what we're doing in Garfield County is emulating what he has talked about. First of all, though, Greg Sheehan and Kevin Bunnell, thank you very much. You've done a wonderful job. You've been given this task on short notice, and you have done a wonderful job. This plan will work. I believe that, and they know I'm a pretty tough customer when it comes to talking about what will work and what won't work. So this will work. I'm going to speak briefly about recovery. We have two goals. We want to meet the federal recovery. We have federal partners. We met with Dan Ash last summer, the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C. We made a commitment to recover that species, and we're sticking to that. In fact, Garfield County, in the first time in 41 years, is meeting that criteria, the minimum count, as of 2014. We feel comfortable that we will not only meet that minimum count in 2015, spring of 2015, but we'll exceed it considerably. So the species is now being delisted on private property in Garfield County at the federal level. And we've got good federal partners. We've had our differences on some things, but on the recovery part of it, Garfield County is 93% federally owned. Now think about that. This needs to be a prairie dog. It's not in the grand scheme of things, it is not an alfalfa dog. It is a prairie dog, okay? And we are taking this species from the alfalfa fields and we're putting it back where it belongs. 93% of our county is federal land. And we have several areas we're expanding that. Yes, plague's an issue. But we're mitigating that as well. We're expanding those recovery areas twofold starting with next year. So what I mean by that, we're acquiring more federal land to recover the species, state land, areas that meet that criteria of recovery. And so I feel good about this. This plan will work. Believe me, it will. And one of the reasons it will work is you have commitment from the county commissioners and our solid commitment to make it work. So with that, is there any questions?
We're good. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Excellent Chair. Job. Thank you for the time.
We appreciate you guys coming to the meeting and giving us those comments this morning, and we wish you good luck during the day. Okay, we'll be going back. Do we have any other questions from the board before I go to questions from the chairs?
I have some questions, and my questions are not because I'm negative towards this. I just but when you have your sliding scale for take, and you've got the various levels and how much effort you can put into taking and how many individuals you can take, the thing that I'm curious about is when you count 2,000 prairie dogs, there's no limit on the take. And I'm wondering what that really means. Can you kill every prairie dog that's on the property?
That means that they'll still be protected wildlife, but they'll probably fall under similar regulations as we currently have for Gunnisons and white-tailed prairie dogs in the state. Is what I imagine. I would love to get to that point, and when we start, and when we do, we'll start defining this. This has the plan, as you read it, says that it will be reviewed annually, and we'll do that. And as we start approaching those numbers, and I hope we get there quickly, as the county commissioner said, there'll certainly have to be some rewriting of the rule at that point to define what that means. But the basis of that is, we feel like that the species is secure. It's double the recovery level that's stipulated by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and with that security out on those lands, the prairie dogs on private land become less important from a conservation standpoint because they're secure out in other areas.
So when you get to that point, that's per landowner.
We'll no longer. There certainly will be some regulation, but we won't be issuing. You can take this many prairie dogs. They'll still be the tools that are available to them. Probably won't change.
Right. But there'll just be no limit as right. to the number they can take.
And the reality of that is, Mike, even under our current scenario, I don't know that we've ever had a landowner completely reach the take that he's been allotted. Even though we're calculating and putting some restrictions on it, they're not getting to that level even now.
And that was my next question: how many landowners out there actually?
Have we ever had one
counting
2,000
on their
property?
They do, but
that's
usually on smaller parcels.
Okay, so if we're gonna talk, we need to come up to the other mic so we get into this part of our minutes.
I'll reiterate. Adam clarified that we have had a couple on smaller colonies where they don't have a large number of prairie dogs have met their annual take, but the larger ones, they're not getting there.
But as far as having somebody with 2,000 prairie dogs on their property, is there anybody approaching that at this point, any place?
Yeah, there are. When you account for the annual production, we have places where we will count 150 prairie dogs. And just to make the math easy, you take that number and times it by 7, it gets you an approximate population estimate. So if you're at 150, you're close to 1,000 prairie dogs on that individual piece of property.
Okay. I'll defer a few more. They'll come up. I'm sure somebody else will ask.
That would be what we may issue under a COR. Simply issuing permits under or authorized take on a COR does not necessarily mean harvest. So we kind of often think if we issue a permit, there's a dead animal. And the limited methods of take that are out there would be very difficult to kill. You know, we issue thousands and thousands of permits every year, and only, you know, some portion of that actually results in harvests.
And what we track is not the number that we've permitted them to take, but the number that's actually been taken. That's the important number that we keep track of.
Okay, any other questions? Bill.
Yeah, Kevin, I'm not familiar with prairie dog social order and things like that, but how good is the survival rate on these that are trapped and relocated?
It's low, but it's getting better. And that social aspect is part of that. We started out at about 5% survival rate on the translocations. We're up over 10% now. But when you compare that to a survival rate of 25%, you know, even without being moved, you know, we're we're half, but it's not like we're 90% different or way different.
Okay, we'll move to the questions from the rack chairs. Do we have any questions from you guys? Go ahead, John.
Kevin, I just had a quick question. What is the impact do you see in terms of removing some of these buffer zones around colonies in regard to connectivity of the populations and the effects on perhaps gene flow and maintenance of population stability?
Yeah, I don't think in these cases, because this is areas that are within municipalities largely. They're already isolated. They've got houses and roads and everything else surrounding them in the areas in what we would call the health and human safety areas or the developable areas. I don't see that there's an impact. Some of the agricultural areas do play a key role in that, but they're not not part of that part of the plan. They're not under the same regulations. Within Cedar City and Enoch and Panguitch and the municipalities, I don't think we're impacting that because they're already in small isolated areas.
Any other questions from the rack chairs? We have any questions from the audience? Please come up to the mic and state your name. I'll remind you that this is questions, not comments.
Hi, Allison Jones, Wild Utah Project. So, Kevin, the agency has a really good track record, I think, of using the precautionary principle and science-based adaptive management with this species and many others. And so my question is, why isn't that better reflected in this plan, specifically with the objective of the 6,000 take on the private lands? As I read it here, it says this take is set at 6,000. And for me, being a non-insider who didn't write the plan, that sounds to me like that'll happen each year no matter what. But then I do see a contingency here that if the current year's spring count exceeds 6,000, then that take on private lands can go up above 6,000. And so my question is, what about the other side of the coin? You know, what if in a terrible drought or with climate change that doesn't lessen or a huge fire through the recovery units, what if the annual counts are way down, you know, 500 per unit? Would the other side of that coin allow you to reduce the take in a year and say we're not going to take 6,000 and do what the service is recommending, perhaps a percentage of the population, because they're worried it could be up to 20% of a given year that's taken? Is that part of your plan?
Let me respond to that with the history of where that 6,000 came from. So initially in 1984, in the 4D rule, they allowed the service allowed for a take of 5,000. They adjusted that up in 1991 to 6,000. So that's been a number that's been in place and never been adjusted downward since 1991. We've been through several drought cycles. In 2001, 02, 03, 04, some of the worst that we've ever had. That number's never been adjusted, and it's never been an issue, and we don't anticipate it being an issue going forward.
Okay, I'll be interested to hear the service's comments on that. And if you do plan to kind of do the other side of the coin, hopefully you'll get it in the plan. So thank you.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay. Please come up and to the mic and state your name. If anybody else has any questions, just please come forward and state your name.
Good day. I'm Larry Crist. I'm the field supervisor with Fish and Wildlife Service, and thanks, Kevin. But I did want to make one point of clarification.
Sorry.
Oops, sorry. You were right up to a point, but in 2012, we issued a new 4D rule that had a 10% of the count, total count take. So it was kind of a sliding one. But that was only starting in 2012 in the most recent one. Up till then, yes, it was that 6,000.
Right. And that's where, and yeah, so I missed that, but yeah. But the 6,000 was in place for 20 plus years.
Sure.
Without issue.
And then in 2012, we changed it to a 10%. Thanks.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to RAC chair summaries, and this is what happened in our RAC meetings. And we're going to start with Boyd, because he's staring right at me right there.
The Northeastern RAC voted unanimously to approve the management plan as presented. Did you want me to also talk about the rule?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, they also voted unanimously to accept the rule as presented.
Okay. Gary, Central Region.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In the Central Region, a motion was made to accept the Prairie Dog Management Plan, and it passed 8-1 with regards to the rule. That was also presented and was approved, and it passed 8-1 as well. And then the last rule, are we to that one yet, or are you going to address that one differently? There were the two rules, the take and then the other animals. The last one passed unanimously.
Okay. John?
Okay, the Northern Regional Council approved a motion as presented for the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan, and it passed unanimously, and the rules also were passed unanimously.
Okay, Robbie, okay. Southeastern.
The Southeastern Region RAC motion to accept the Prairie Dog Management Plan as presented. 7 in favor, 1 opposed. And Southeastern Region RAC also motion to accept Rule 657-70 and R657-3 as presented. 7 in favor and 1 opposed. They also motion to accept the rule R657-19 with also a recommendation was made that while we are making changes to this rule, that it would be an opportune time to include a provision for the proper disposal of all non-game mammals shot with lead ammunition. It was discussed as a concern in regards to mostly eagles and
slide your mic up just a little bit, will you, Rob?
Were you able to hear that? Or
yeah, there you go. Okay. So the last part of that was on the lead?
Yes. On the lead, there was a concern with the proper, to ensure the proper disposal of all non-game species in regards to species such as eagles, which could consume these animals that are taken and not properly disposed of could lead to lead poisoning. In these.
Okay. Dave Black, Southern Region.
Mr. Chairman, in the Southern Region, we had a motion to accept the Prairie Dog Management Plan as presented with a vote of 11 in favor and 1 abstention. And then regarding the rule amendments, the three different rules, we had the same vote.
Okay. We're going to, this time, we'll go to our comment cards. Right. So we're on item 5 right now, and then item 6 is rule amendments. But on item 5, I have 2 comment cards. The first is Larry Christ. You'll come up to that same mic you was at, and you'll be followed by Ken Strong.
This was just a copy of what comments and recommendations I'll make, just so you have a hard copy. Good day, and appreciate the opportunity to comment. Most of our comments were primarily on the regulation itself, but I did want to say in general that, you know, prairie dogs often been a controversial subject and a point of contention, but we do share the goal of balancing Utah prairie dog conservation and continued private property land uses. That is, we absolutely share that goal with Division of Wildlife here. We're also encouraged by the state and county efforts to increase the recovery actions and actions on federal and other protected lands. You know, just recently, Garfield County has approached us about getting and using Section 6, which are federal dollars, to acquire some lands that could be managed for prairie dogs within Garfield County, and that's a possibility. So we're looking at those types of things. And we also recognize Division of Wildlife Resources' authority and intent to manage prairie dogs as a protected species, consistent with the ongoing recovery efforts. And then, based on that, we did have some concerns, though, that were coming up relative to the plan and the regulations. And the concerns were, and some of these are based perhaps on a little bit of confusion on numbers and looking at the same facts, but our basic concern with the plan was that it had the potential to allow for a much increased level of take on private lands, and that that might preclude to some degree the ability to recover on federal and protected lands, which we all agree is the ultimate goal. And so I've listened with interest to some of this discussion about, you know, how a permit doesn't necessarily equal take. But as we have looked at the plan, you know, that is our concern, is that under a worst case scenario, let's say, that a permit can equal take, and so that there could be enough take under the plan and associated regulations that it could impact the ability to recover the species. And so I'll leave it at that for the plan. I do have some specific recommendations relative to the regulations, on ways we think it could be improved a little bit, and I can talk to those, I guess, separately. Okay.
Go ahead and tell us what your, give us your input while you're there.
Okay. Well, specifically, you know, we talked about poisons earlier here, and I listened with interest to that discussion and about how the label and off-label uses are illegal and won't happen. Our big concern was with the off-label use and the potential for it to happen, and our recommendation was that, given the fact it's kind of a truth in advertising, so we would like to see the regulations actually specifically state that poisons and fumigants, gaseous agents, those type of things, would be illegal for take of prairie dog under this rule. And so to me, it is kind of a truth in advertising thing. If they really are illegal, let's go ahead and say it so people are aware of it, because we are concerned about, I think, the off-label uses. There have been cases that have been investigated in the past where rat poison combined with peanut butter and things have been used to exterminate or to take prairie dogs. And essentially, our concern with poisons is it's an efficient way to remove prairie dogs, and it could be applied on a large scale. And also, it's very difficult if dogs are poisoned to monitor the take that's going on. So that would be one recommendation. Related to that, in that same part of the regulation, which is R657014, it refers to, authorizes all take methods permitted under state, local, or federal law. And we would suggest a simple change of, instead of state, local, or federal law, to state, local, and federal law. Quite frankly, this is a suggestion from one of our solicitors, and it would make them very happy. So, under R657-70-6-7, and I think also 8, one of the things that we were looking at was the idea of translocations. And I understand, based on the conversations here, is that the DWR is going to be translocating, but we would like to see under the plan and also the regulations that actually be specified as being prioritized. Did I say something wrong? Now, in our mind, it would add a little more impetus to the idea that translocation would be the first priority, and that we would like to see that happen. And we really believe that translocation is going to be an effective way of moving prairie dogs off private lands, and then also using those same dogs in federal and protected areas where they can assist with meeting recovery goals. Another recommendation would be under R657-70-9 and 11, is to consider a fluctuating take allowance based on a percentage of the population rather than a fixed rate to ensure that high levels of prairie dogs are not lethally taken during low population levels. The prairie dog is subject to, at times, some extreme population fluctuations. We've been doing really good lately. I think that's due to a combination of good conditions, but primarily to the good management that's been put on them. I think we're achieving success there. But we are concerned that if you did have reductions in populations with a straight 6,000 take level, you may be impacting the population severely if they were to decline. So we would suggest something more similar to what we had suggested in our last 4D rule, or had in our last 4D rule, which was a 10% limitation on the amount of take. Now, right now, you know, we just did a quick back of the envelope calculation this morning. There's a lot of prairie dogs. Right now, you'd be up around 10% is roughly 6,000 anyway. But under lower periods, it would be less. So just for a little bit of comparison. And then under 657-70-7 and 10, we would ask that you avoid take on developable lands from January 1st through June 15th because of the adult population, the impacts to adult populations could be greater during that time frame. You know, in the past, what we did was we emphasized, like during the winter, under previous HCPs when they were done, our approach under those had been, let's take a, if you have to develop in the winter, let's assess a mitigation fee to help with the recovery. But I think the best thing to do would be to wait until we could translocate those animals if possible. So, again, if we could prioritize something like that, that would be a recommendation. And then finally, we would just encourage that you continue to monitor the programs like you're planning to, and perhaps even expand them a little bit so that changes in population are readily apparent. And I think that's really part of the rule. I don't have a real serious concern there, but we would like to be able to see the populations kind of year by year and make sure that things can be adjusted if it goes south. Hopefully it won't. So those are my basic recommendations.
Okay, while you're right there, any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. On the take, on that 6,000 number, is that maximum?
Now,
did I miss something? Isn't there a formula? If you have, you know, 1 to 999, it's so much, and then as it goes up, you can take more. Isn't there a formula that tells how many you can take?
And here's where I guess maybe I'll have to get Kevin back up here.
Right, and maybe
so that we have a common understanding. Yeah. My understanding was that 6,000 is the maximum. Would be, it actually can be a little bit more if the numbers are high, but that would be a maximum allowable take. And the others were a formula for on agricultural lands.
So the 6,000 under the current population scenarios out on the protected land, 6,000 would be the maximum take. There is a provision
that on protected land.
Well, actually, the 6,000. Let me restate that. If populations are very high on private land, then the amount of take that we would allow would go up on the private land. We're not in that scenario right now. We may this spring if populations are high, but it's a fairly conservative increase. It's half of the counted number, which accounts for maybe 10 or 20% of the actual increase of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let me clarify the other thing, that it's somewhat self-regulating. The majority of the population, about 70% of it, that's on the private land is on the agricultural lands. And because of that formula that was alluded to, if the populations go down, the number of prairie dogs we count on an individual land piece of land is going to go down. Therefore, the amount of take that we allocate to them is going to go down. And so it's self-limiting in that and adjusts itself as populations fluctuate up and down. Just by the way we take the number that we counted that spring to calculate how much take we're going to allocate to an individual landowner. So as populations go down, the amount of take automatically goes down.
So is the 6,000 take limit on the whole area of where there are prairie dogs.
Right. That's range wide.
That's range wide. I mean, it's not on some guy's 10-acre parcel. That's the whole area on the first map that you showed in that color.
Well, no, that map just showed the Cedar and Enoch area as an example. So that's where prairie dogs exist in Iron County, in Garfield County, in mm-hmm. Wayne County.
Yeah, that whole area, your maximum take is 6,000.
Yes, 6,000. Okay. And that, yeah. Well, 6,000 that's accounted for, that's within for agricultural take, developable areas, and on rangelands. We don't subtract, according to the plan, the way it's written, we don't subtract prairie dogs that are taken for health and human safety areas
right.
off of that 6,000.
Or on unmapped land.
Or on unmapped land, which.
And that's what I thought. There's a limit, but there's also a formula that tells you what you can and can't take up to that 6,000.
Right, and that formula only applies to the agricultural lands.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Which again is where the majority of them that are on private land occur.
Okay. Thanks, Larry.
Could I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry.
A couple of questions of Larry.
Go ahead.
Uh-oh.
So, Larry and I talked earlier this morning, so.
Yeah, we're still working some numbers out here.
Yeah.
So.
But there's a couple. The letter that you submitted to the mm-hmm. board yesterday and that the audience can get a copy of, I think there's plenty of on the table. First of all, we appreciate that, and there's certainly some good comments and support for moving forward. But on the second page, there's a few points I'd like to work with you publicly to clarify. Your letter is a matter of administrative mm-hmm. record, and this meeting is a matter of administrative record. So there's a few points that I think we need to get some clarification on in case these should come up again somewhere in a different venue. The first paragraph, or the second paragraph of the page two, it begins with "based on our discussions." The fourth line down, it talks about a plan with an unmitigated take of 6,000 prairie dogs on developable and rangelands. It says, in the past, we've authorized an average of 1,000 prairie dogs annually. Mm-hmm. I want to get some clarification. Why don't you clarify
sure.
that, Larry? It's your letter. And then I'll see if I can jump in.
So. What we did was, in the past, that sentence, in the past, we've authorized the take of an average of about 1,000 prairie dogs. That is based on information from about 1991 to 2010 of the levels of take that had been authorized under rules at that time. I think it was presented in our recovery plan, and that was documented in there. So there is a time period on that from 91 to 2010. Since then, populations, and we just had this conversation this morning, have expanded some. And I, as I understand it, under using, for instance, I get in touchy areas. We don't have a 4D rule in effect because of the judge's ruling, but if it was, I think we'd be higher than that now. We could authorize higher levels than, for instance, 1,000 currently if we were using that 10% formula under the 4D rule. And then let me ask Laura, would it be around 3,000 dogs or so?
We need to have her come up to the mic. If we can, so we can get that into the record. Please state your name also.
Yeah, Laura Roman. I'm with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Adam actually has the numbers, but I think in 2014, we were still under the 4D rule, the 2012 4D rule. The take was about 3,800 because the populations were very high that year. The year before that was about 1,800. And the year before that, about 3,200. So the take is higher because the populations are higher. But that's why we recommend the fluctuating take level to allow for that.
Right. But the 1,000 number was based on the period of 91 to 2010.
Right. So okay. I guess the point I'd like to make is, again, the appearance is now there's going to be 6,000 killed a year, and there were only 1,000. The 1,000 goes back sometime. We haven't had any years in the last 5 years that have been under 1,000. Last few you mentioned, Laura, have been 3,200, 3,800, those numbers that you mentioned. They've been pretty robust. We issued over 7,200 permits last year for take. So
Right. So I agree that within the last few years, the numbers would have been more like 1,800 to 3,800 in that range.
Right. And even with a fluctuating rate of about 10%, you would still be seeing those kind of numbers. The point being, if the populations go back down, that then your take numbers would go down accordingly.
Right. Definitely. So my only – and we'll let Kevin comment. My only point here is to clarify that we haven't been allowing 1,000, and now we're allowing 6,000. We've been allowing under all of those, you know, federal provisions and 4D and our plans out there, you know, many thousand, and not allowing a cap of 1,000. That somebody may misinterpret that, and I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, Kevin. I do want to clarify that because I think the letter's a little maybe misworded there. The 1,000 number is the average of the actual take, not what was allowed. According to the 4D rule, 6,000
was the actual take.
6,000 was the allowable take. 1,000 was the average of what was actually taken. And so that 6,000 number was what could have been allowed during that entire time frame.
Right. That's a correct clarification.
Right. So I just want everyone to understand. We're not jumping from a, wow, we've got this state authority now. Forget 1,000. We're going for 6,000. You know, very little has really changed. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to keep an essential, you know, framework of what's existed out there. And there's been additional take and on these non-agricultural lands as well. Golf courses, cemeteries, people's homes, airports, all of that. That's additional take that's been allowed under all the, you know, a number of years of federal oversight on there, and some of that would continue as well under our plan. So we're certainly not trying to do anything to jeopardize the population or viability of these populations in a disadvantageous way. We want to keep the state authority. We want to demonstrate the federal government and others that we can do this well. But I don't think that this plan that's laid out before everyone here is a significant deviation of what we've been seeing in the past. So.
Thanks, sir.
So, Larry, while you're right there, did you agree with just what Kevin pointed out there when he was up to the mic then?
Yeah, that there was a permitted level of up to 6,000, or it could happen up to that level, but in reality, what the real level of take, even during the 1991 to 2010 period, was on average around 1,000, although it could have gone higher if requested, in essence.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? I'm just looking at the participants in this plan, and maybe I've missed it, but I don't see the Fish and Wildlife Service on that list.
We unfortunately were not able to participate in the development because of some staffing.
So. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay.
However, okay. I will say that we provided input. You know, we have a number of plans. We have the recovery plans, and we had a outline for management objectives and plans that we provided. So,
and Dr. King and I think Larry can verify they were invited to participate in this development committee. So.
Were these recommendations that you've brought here today, were they submitted to the group working on this plan prior to
these
today?
Have only been recently developed. So, no, they weren't considered during the actual plan development itself. I think some of the general concepts were, you know, taken into consideration, but not these specifics that we brought forward here. Would that be fair to say, Greg, I think?
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Ken Strong. You're good? Okay, I'm also going to read into the minutes right now on this is a letter from the Humane Society. It says, could you please address the following comments regarding a Utah prairie dog to the Central Area RAC? Humane Society of the United States Prairie Dog Coalition is a national organization with associated Utah members. Wildlife Earth Guardians is a national organization with 137 Utah members. Defenders of Wildlife is a national organization with 8,700 Utah members and supporters. On behalf of these organizations and their Utah members, we would like you to make the following comments to the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan known to the Central Area RAC and our Utah Wildlife Board meeting today.
we suggest the state of Utah continue protection efforts on private land in alignment with federal standards developed under the 4D rule. This plan should conform to the rule. Number two, Utah prairie dogs are still currently protected under the ESA, regardless of the stability of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services to regulate take on private lands. This management plan should reflect the continued progress to achieve of recovery goals. Excessive take allowances will limit or defeat progress towards delisting. And to the end, we urge the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources to maintain the take limits as prescribed under the 4D rule. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. Sincerely, I don't know how to pronounce that. I think it's Gia Zalawa. I can't remember. Anyway, I'm out on that one. Program manager of the Utah Humane Society, United States Prairie Dog Coalition. And all you guys have a copy of this, am I correct? Okay. We also had the letter from the United States Department Fish and Wildlife Services, and I think Director Sheehan and Larry have covered that pretty much. The only other one that I would like to maybe bring forward is Marty Bushman. You come up to the mic and give us your take on methods of take, if you would.
My name is Marty Bushman. I'm with the Attorney General's Office assigned to the Division of Wildlife Resources. my take on methods of take, is that? we have had some discussions with the Fish and Wildlife Service over the past several days concerning the issue on use of toxicants and fumigants to take prairie dogs. And I think in doing that, we have proposed or at least have some language here before you that may address that. What we would do is amend the provision that deals with methods of take to state specifically that Environmental Protection Agency regulations currently prohibit the use of toxicants and fumigants on Utah prairie dogs. So that statement would be placed right in the body of methods of take. Also, with regard to the suggestion from the solicitor's office that in the series of laws that are referenced saying that you can only take prairie dogs by methods authorized under local, state, we had it written originally, or federal law. It's been suggested by the solicitor's office we change that to and federal law, and we are comfortable with that as well.
Okay, so under our rule of R657-7014, it person authorized to take Utah prairie dog under this chapter may lethally remove the animal using any means permitted by state, local, and federal.
Correct.
Out the R. And Environmental Protection Agency regulations currently prohibit the use of toxins and fumigants on Utah prairie dogs, except as provided in the rule 657-70-8, right? As authorized by the division in a certificate of registration.
The only change to the original language on that EPA regulation, if I remember correctly, was just saying that EPA regulations currently prohibit the use of toxicants and fumigants.
So that would answer my question. Can you do that? Obviously, you can do a lot of things, but it's against the law because the EPA said you can't do that.
Correct.
And that would also would cover your question, Mr. Lewis, that you know, you don't want to list all the different products out there. We wouldn't have enough paper for that. But if we put this in here, and apparently it is in here, that you can't use those toxicants and fumigants for that purpose because they're not labeled for that purpose.
It would put people on notice of EPA regulations.
Right. I mean, I can use phostoxin to fumigate the grain in the grain bin, but I can't use the same thing down a burrow to take care of a prairie dog.
Utah prairie dog, correct.
The Utah prairie dog, correct. Okay.
The EPA is going to be very careful right now because the prairie dog has been and still is on federal land listed as threatened. And so they're not going to be authorizing toxicants to
Right.
Threatened species.
Okay. Let me ask then a question to Mr. Lewis. Does this language where it says, you know, the EPA regulations currently prohibit this, does this cover what you wanted as far as making them not available or not, you can't use them?
I think by Lewis you mean Christ.
Yes, excuse me. Excuse me. I'm sorry. No, no, I'm sorry.
Could we have you come up to the mic there again? I'm sorry.
Just so I clarify, the rule that has been presented so far, R657-70-14, is reflected in this. The underlined language is new language that's being proposed today.
Okay, so that would be new added to if we approved that.
If you approve it.
Okay.
You know, I think this would work
for us. And I'm thinking this would probably cover your concerns of what you can and can't use under a take.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you're okay with that?
Yes, we're okay with that.
All right. Any other question? Bill?
Yeah, Marty, on your point number two under the methods of take, it's I'm just a tad confused on this. I thought the preferred take was to translocate dogs. So why wouldn't you want a person to be able to trap it alive if you're going to try and...
The translocation and trapping will be performed by the division and those who it authorizes.
Oh,
not
okay.
Really interested in having private landowners trap them and not quite sure what to do with them at that point, and maybe go release them in their neighbor's yard or the next field, and we just go through the process again.
So, all right, thanks for
Dr.
clarifying
King
that.
Could address moving them, you know, they come back.
I'd ask a question about that. How does this tie in with what's going on in the legislature right now and the proposal to make it illegal to release endangered species? Is that fit into this? Would that be covered by what they're doing up there?
The rule, I think, was written before I was aware of that, but yes, it would also run into that as well, as that there is a law being proposed right now making release of an endangered species in an area that is not currently inhabited by it illegal. This will keep us in line with that as well, if that law passes.
Your white tails.
Whitetails are okay.
But they're more like
you can't put it in
like
your, can't put it in your pesky neighbor's mailbox.
Thank you, Marty. Appreciate your time there. That concludes our comment cards and our comment section of today. I'm just going to summarize our RAC motions and what happened in the five areas of the state. All of the regions voted to approve the plan. There was the central region had one opposed, southern region had one abstained, and the southeastern region also had one opposed. And then also there was some discussion about the removal of lead and the animals from the area after they've been taken care of. Looks to me like that'll have to come back in some sort of another rule if that's where you guys decide to go with that. Am I right, Kevin? You see anything there so that we can answer their question or their motion down there? You have that on some other areas in the state of Utah.
Well, we do understand what the Southeastern RAC was trying to accomplish there, and it's a valid point, but I think it's a point that probably deserves being aired across the whole state with a specific recommendation if we were ever going to go there, rather than being attached to something that's related but not specifically on that issue.
And that's the way I would look at it, is some type of recommendation is going to have to come back from the division on that at a later time and not be part of today's amendment to the rule or anything like that.
There will certainly be some controversy related to that. And so to have it just come out of a single rack, and certainly you can do whatever you'd like, but since you asked, my recommendation would be if something like that was to come through the process, it would need to go through the whole process.
Can I just make a comment on that? I received phone calls last night both from Chris Wood, the Southeast Region a supervisor, and also from Darris Jones. Darris, I think most of you know, was the RAC member that actually proposed that. And I was not able to attend the meeting because of some other commitments, so I didn't really hear the discussion. But Darris's main concern was that the motion that came forward in the minutes did not reflect what he actually proposed. There's nothing in the motion in the minutes or that summary sheet that we got that mentions lead at all. It just talks about wasting and, well, not necessarily wasting, but taking care of the dead animals and removing them or taking care of them properly, whether it's through burial or hauling that off and so on. In other words, taking the potential lead out of the environment after those animals, not necessarily prairie dogs even, are killed. And Robbie, you can jump in here if I'm misstating anything. And then Chris wanted me to make sure that I understood that as well. But then there were also some other comments from folks in Iraq, maybe those that voted against it, that, you know, there are things that come into play that you probably ought to consider before going about this and just saying we should do this right now. And that's the fact that you do have situations where you've got animals out there that are dead that could be infected with the disease, and people are worried about picking those up and hauling them back to town and whatever the case might be. So there's a variety of things that would come into that decision. And so I think what Kevin says about revisiting this maybe in the future, looking at it in more detail, because it is obviously a concern. And the thing that popped into my mind, and whether or not this is actually a problem or not, but you've got California condors not too far away from the historic range, if not the actual range of these prairie dogs right now. Whether or not they would waste their time on a dead prairie dog or not, I don't know. There's not a whole lot of meat there for a big bird like a condor. But you also have golden eagles that will scavenge, and they are very likely to take something like that. And so that would be a concern that I might have. And then also, I don't have any idea about burrowing owls, whether or not they eat carrion. I know they eat live things, but whether or not they eat dead things or not, but that's certainly within their range and a species of concern in Utah. So those are on kind of a little bit of a watch list. So that's kind of what I gathered from both Chris and from Darris, was that, and that motion, that recommendation passed. So there was some concern from that RAC specifically about that. So that's what I understand. Robbie?
Yeah, can I just maybe add? I think part of the motivation for bringing this up was to prevent a regulation on the use of lead ammunition. It was kind of where Darris was coming from, was if we are proactive in maybe providing a provision in the proper disposal of these animals, by doing that, it may help to prevent the regulation of the use of lead ammunition, which could cause problems. So kind of the motivation for that, from what I understood.
Mr. Bates, would you like to comment?
I would. I'd like to make this simple for you. I think this is a bigger issue with the white-tailed prairie dog and Gunnison prairie dog. I think what they're thinking about is when people go out and shoot a lot of prairie dogs out in the Cisco Desert, places like that, that's really what the concern that they have. We have some plans that there's probably some things we'd like to change in regards to take of other species of prairie dogs that we would bring forward maybe next year or sometime in the future and address this issue at that time.
Addressing lead ammunition.
It might be something we could bring up at that time. But Greg, Director Sheehan, is the chairman of the OFWA non-lead group, and this is an issue wide. But the lead issue itself is something that I think we need to talk about internally and kind of come up with what our plan is. But that could be part of it. Talking about disposal of animals at that time, it'd be much more appropriate there than I think it is in this situation. So,
would it be appropriate to put that on the action log? bring us a report at some point in time without us doing that?
An action log might be nice, just yeah. to make
just
sure
bring
we don't
a report back.
About
yeah.
it.
Well, I then would make a motion that we put this issue of looking into, I don't even know how to word it, but if I had Darris's motion here, I might be able to do that. But looking into the potential impacts of leaving killed wildlife out in the field and the potential for lead poisoning issues to be looked at a later date to come back to the board after the division's had a chance to study that a little bit and investigate whether or not that's something that needs further consideration.
Okay, so we have a motion by Mike King to put this particular item on the action log, which would investigate lead poisoning, Utah prairie dog, and the other dogs that are listed in the, or not listed in the state but are taken in the state to the effects of lead poisoning. Is that cover up?
Yeah, the potential problems that might exist as a result of, I mean, if you're going to go out and kill 6,000 prairie dogs with 22s, you know, who knows what might happen.
We'd be glad to bring it. We could. As Bill mentioned, I chair the National Council or Committee on it's called Lead and Wildlife Committee through the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And I guess knowing some of the research that we look at regarding doves and condors and golden eagles and these different things, I have some degree of awareness of what sort of research is out there. So we could come back and talk about what we're doing now. We could talk about the you know, use on non-game, but there probably is not going to be a significant amount of research out there just because I pretty much know what's out there on these lead issues. We could see what we could find, but it may not be that black and white. We may be able to give you what's out there, and you could do with that information what you would.
I think it would be good just to spark some conversation about it.
Hey, we have a second by Bill Fenimore. Any other discussion from you gentlemen? Okay, so all in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. 1, 2, unanimous. Okay, we'll add that to the action log. Okay, we're through our comment cards. We're through our questioning. I summarized the RAC motions.
Can I just bring up a couple other things before we move on here?
Sure.
I'm curious as to what the division thinks might happen as a result of this relative to law enforcement issues. Is that something that you think, I mean, obviously it's going to come into place at some point in time, but how's this going to impact your law enforcement folks?
In what context, Mike?
Well, do you think that there are going to be violations, increased numbers of violations relative to taking? Are you going to have people doing things illegally, putting poison grain down baits? Are you going to have them?
I think the incentive or the motivation for people to do that is probably greatly reduced from what it has been because there's more ability to take care of that. Those issues the issues that have created that motivation in the past, we've investigated those sorts of things, as has the Fish and Wildlife Service in the past. I think this lessens that motivation rather than increases it. And we'll continue to respond. If there's illegal activity, certainly we're going to address it.
And to go along with that, I think that maybe some of that ties back into this education goal that you have.
Yes,
as part
and
of
I meant to say that'll be a large component of making sure we make people aware of what the new regulations are based on what the board decides today.
And then going along with that as well, it looked to me like that the way it was written, a lot of the education aspect was directed towards landowners and the kind of things that they could and couldn't do and the permits that they would need to get and when they could take and when they couldn't and counts and all those kind of things. I personally think it would be good also in that, maybe this is part of your plan, would be to throw in a little portion in there about the You mentioned in your plan the keystone species concept for prairie dogs, and I think that might be something that landowners ought to have an idea about as well. That, you know, they do, you know, they're an important part of ecosystems. They provide ecological services.
They are certainly
in a variety of ways,
you know, and part of the outreach needs to talk about the conservation side of the plan and the role that prairie dogs play.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we're hearing that prairie dogs are a big nuisance, but not much is being said about their value. I mean, they're not just out there intending to cause problems for people.
And that's
they do other good stuff, and they get eaten by good stuff. So,
and I think that tone has come up in this process largely because we're dealing with private land, which is where the issues occur. But you know, as Commissioner Miller indicated, there's still a lot of buy-in and emphasis placed on the conservation side and making sure that that prairie dog populations are secure.
Part of your incentive program is to promote that a little bit, right? To tolerate the damage. If you're going to pay me $49 a prairie dog for it, I'll let them be out there.
Exactly. And since you bring that up, Mike, I did want to make a comment on that. The numbers that were talked about on take when Larry was up here, that incentive program will bring those numbers down considerably, because the largest landowners that we've dealt with that have the largest number of prairie dogs, we've already visited with them. We know that there's some interest out there, and some of those guys that we have been giving permits to take several hundred prairie dogs, if they're now enrolled in this plan, that's take that has been out there in the past that no longer will be. We'll be trapping and translocating those prairie dogs, which is a much better scenario.
And if I can add to that, there's a national effort on the recovery of the black-footed ferret. And we modeled this incentive program similarly after that, which is where we can find landowners who are willing to have some tolerance of this species. In that case, it's helped the recovery of the prairie dog. So many states have an incentivized program for leaving prairie dogs alone on these private lands, and that was a good cornerstone for us to follow in this incentive plan.
And just anecdotally, the day after the Southern Region RAC meeting, one of the largest producers in the area came into our office saying, "Can I fill out my application for the incentive program?" We had to say, "Well, we've got to get through the board. We've got to make sure that the funding comes through." But there's already interest there to be part of that incentive program.
One last question, then I'll shut up. You've already mentioned this, but you say the plan is to be reviewed annually.
Yes.
When does that happen? Does that happen before you set take amounts for the year?
Yeah, the most appropriate time for that would be to be kind of December-January time frame when we, you know, that the prairie dogs are largely inactive at that time.
Wouldn't that go back to our non-consumptive meeting?
Could, yeah, it certainly could. This time of year, maybe January, February would be the right time to do that. And the analysis could be, things are working and we don't want to make any changes, but it could be otherwise as well, and that's when we would bring it.
But at least it would be reviewed.
And that goes back to this adaptive management kind of thing.
Exactly.
Approach that's been mentioned in the letters.
That's certainly one of the an aspect of the plan is to adapt as we move forward. We're charting, you know, some unplowed ground here, and we're going to have to learn and adapt as we go.
Just for clarification, that we would bring that out probably as informational item annually. We're not going to reopen the plan every year as an action
item. And I don't know that it even needs to come informationally if things are going well, but we could if the board would like us to.
But you are going to make changes if you deem them necessary.
Certainly. Yeah, we will evaluate what we've on an annual basis, what worked, what didn't, what issues came up, are there changes that need to be made? Those questions will be asked every year.
Okay. I think we've talked about Utah prairie dogs for about 2 hours. So, in a summary, everybody's got some questions and some good points. But I think from what I've seen working, I attended one meeting of this in Cedar City. And then I didn't go to the others because those people that were in charge of that really knew what they were talking about, and they were hands-on approach with different attorneys from Natural Resource and Marty and those commissioners from Iron and
Garfield, Wayne, you know, they've dealt with this problem for years, and they don't want to go in there and abuse it and have it back in the court system. They want this thing to work, and they've designed it to work. And when I was the mayor in Panguitch, you know, you couldn't go to the Little League ball game without the kids and the Prairie Dogs. You couldn't go to the racetrack. You couldn't even go to the courthouse without these animals being part of your life every day. So, you know, this is a big undertaking. But I honestly think that Kevin and his crew statewide have done a good job on this plan, and I think we need to move forward. So I'd ask for a motion to approve the plan with the amendment that Marty brought forth.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Amendment to the rule, which is our one.
Now, are we going to adopt the management plan and then come back and pick up R657-7 rules and amendments?
So, good point, Calvin. So we actually need
two motions, one for the plan, and the next motion would be for the rule.
Right.
Okay.
So thanks for bringing that out.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I move that we accept the DWR's prey dog management plan as presented.
We have a motion by Calvin to accept the Utah Prairie Dog plan as presented here today. Do we have a second? Second by Steve Dalton. Any other discussion? All in favor? Motion carries unanimous. Okay, so the second part, papers everywhere, is item 6, and we have some comment cards on these. So we'll go back to Kevin, do you have anything else to say before we go to comments on those? Okay. We have any other questions from Wildlife Board on these? Do we have any questions from the RAC chairs on these? Any questions from the audience? Okay, so I'm going to go to... We already did a RAC chair summary on these. So we got a couple of cards. We've already heard from Commissioner Miller and Commissioner Pollack. Brian, have you got anything that you'd like to comment on behalf of those two? You good?
Just very supportive.
All right. Larry Crist, you got any other comments?
No further comments.
All right. Thank you. So we have no other comment cards, so we're to a board discussion and motion on that also.
Well, if there's no comments, I'm prepared for a motion.
I'm ready.
I move we approve R657-7 as presented, and would that be with your amendment, as amended or with the amendment? And including Mr. Bushman's amendment as presented.
Okay, so we're just dealing with the first one then, right? R657-70 with the amendment that Marty presented to us here today.
-14 methods of take.
Right, methods of take.
Can we roll all the rule changes into one motion, or do you want each one separate?
I believe you can do them. The RACs all handled all of the rules as a single motion. They're all related to this issue.
Right, and that would be my motion, is that they're all included with Mr. Bushman's amendment.
Right, and the amendment only applies to 70, but 657-19 and 657, I think 3 it is, are also amended.
Yes, that would be my motion, is to bring all those into one motion.
Okay, so we have a motion by Calvin to accept Rule R657-70 with amendment methods of take, which also includes Rule R657-19 and Rule R657-3. Do we have a second? Steve Dalton. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Do we have any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Once again, unanimous. That concludes our Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan and Rules. And we're going to take a five-minute break.
Can I ask one question before we break?
Yep.
You hurry. What is the current status of this whole notion of switching from federal control to state control from a legal perspective? Have there been appeals made? Lawsuits filed.
We're operating under the ruling. There has been an appeal filed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. Marty tells me that will likely take 18 to 24 months to play out, and then lots of different things could happen. But
right.
There hasn't been any motions for stay or anything like that, and there's probably no reason. We don't anticipate those happening. So
it's critical to have this in place so
absolutely.
That you can take care of it during that time period, whatever it
might be. Absolutely, and hopefully well beyond there.
So. Okay, we'll be back at 11:15, wall clock time. We're going to go ahead and get started as soon as Mr. Fenimore gets up here. Watch that step. I did.
Just a thought for you.
Our next item on the agenda is an informational item only. Earlier this year, we had a legislative request of the Wildlife Board regarding primitive weapons, and Robin Cahoon is here today to give us some information on that and maybe some direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Robin Cahoon from the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. So as the chairman alluded to earlier in this session, Senate Bill 45, called Crossbow Hunting Provisions, was proposed by Senator Jenkins from Plain City. The bill allowed the use of a crossbow during an archery hunt and essentially directed the Wildlife Board to make that so. The DWR and Chairman Albrecht via telephone met with the bill sponsor and respectfully requested that he allow the Regional Advisory Council and Wildlife Board process to address the issue. Now, with the understanding that an informational presentation on this issue would be made to the RACs and board during the 2015 interim, Senator Jenkins agreed to do that. And on February 20th, he made a motion to strike the enacting clause to his bill. That motion passed, and his bill was effectively killed. I'm here to request that the board place an action log relative to having the division study primitive type weapons and the gear that's used in conjunction with those items placed on the action log, and ask us to report back to the Rackham Board via an informational presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. As she mentioned earlier, that we had a telephone call where I was able to speak with Senator Jenkins, and Robin was also there, and I'm sure some of the others in the room, Director Sheehan. And basically what he wanted to do is what Robin described, and I told him that I would bring this up at the Wildlife Board meeting to see if we couldn't get it on the action log, which I really thought would be fairly easy. So Director Sheehan came up with a little paragraph here. It says the division will prepare for the Wildlife Board for the August 2015 board meeting an informational status review of allowable primitive and non-primitive weapon usages compared with other states. Additionally, a review of evolving technology in hunting weapons and related devices and optics. That review should include but not be limited to use of crossbows of various categories of archery hunts, magnified optics on muzzleloading rifles, calibers of firearms allowed on rifle and pistol hunts, draw poundage and sighting devices on archery equipment, as well as use of self-firing rifles. So we've expanded it to use everything that's modern nowadays, and Vision will come back with some recommendations. I'd ask for a motion that we put.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman, that we put that
action log,
that on the action log, as stated by the director.
Okay, so we have a motion by Mr. Kirk Woodward, and a second by Mr. Fenimore. Any other discussion? All in favor? Motion carries unanimous. I don't have any other business. Anybody got anything?
Maybe I could ask, so there's not too many folks left in the room. So I mentioned that language, archery and crossbows and muzzleloaders, rifles, pistols, bows, self-firing rifles. I think you're familiar with those. Is there something else that you can think of that you're seeing evolve? That we just want to bring you a basket of what's going on out there.
You mentioned and optics.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you have, anything that you see that comes up?
Well, some of the ones we've heard about are I don't know if I should name a brand, but tracking point rifles has come up a fair amount, and the use of those on hunting. Don't know that we're recommending or not. I think what we'll probably do is just tell you what's out there and how these things work. A couple of years ago, we did a field day on crossbows to help inform. You know, maybe we ought to look at that. But there's certainly a lot of new technology out there, and we need to just know that we're keeping up with it. Whether we're adopting it or not, it's entirely up to you. But we at least need to be talking about it. So.
Well, and I think when those hunts were set up, the archery hunt and the muzzleloading hunt, they were set up as primitive weapon hunts. So I think we need to look at, is that equipment still a primitive weapon, or have we moved up to the what modernization has done? Let's see which direction you're going to go.
Right.
Are you just looking for weapon? Or what about the use of drones?
We already have that precluded through our rules and in our guidebook, so that's out now. If there's something new on that you want addressed, we could.
Wondering if that's going to be part of.
I think drones are out. So.
I'm looking for cattle. Let's just get it out there right now. There are some places I can't ride my horse through. It's a jungle, and so I'm using it to find cows in certain places.
While in your living room on the couch, right?
Looking for cows. Yeah.
Those horses are
and
it
just
be mad,
because it happens to be in the middle of, you know, October 1 to, you know, November 15.
Well, there
no
was
that's when I gather my cattle anyway. Yeah.
At WAFWA this last summer, we went to a workshop on drone use in wildlife management, and so I mean there are some valid uses for drones, not in hunting, I don't think, but in
I'm going to say they use it in range management over to look at where fires have been, where they've reseeded to look at things. They use it quite a bit.
Well, and the other thing is getting into places with bighorn sheep that's just really difficult to get to, where it's dangerous to fly.
You can hover 20 foot out from a cliff and look at him right in the eye, can't you?
Okay. Before we adjourn, I need to see if we can have four board members for a hearing that will be the day before the Wildlife Board meeting in April. So I think it's the 29th. And I need four people to be here. So Mike thinks he can. Steve knows he can.
I can.
Calvin, Bill, myself, Doctor, maybe. But we have four. Okay, so we might have a full house. I don't know. That's don't anybody tell John, okay? We can be out of here a little earlier.
That's the day before the board meeting on April 29th.
Yes. Whoever tells John will be no lunch.
I'm texting him now.
Great. Okay, we have no other business, so our meeting is adjourned for the day.